We're delighted to have you here with us today. For those who don't know me, my name is Mary Angela De Grazia De Tucci. I'm a longtime patient with digestive motility disorders, and I have a host of other diseases. In 1991, I was so privileged to establish the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, known as AGMD, where I've humbly served for over 30 years. The AGMD is a nonprofit international organization established in 1991. It serves as an integral education resource for GI motility. It also functions as an important clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. And AGMD provides a form of support for patients and their families suffering from GI motility disorders. I'd like to introduce Melissa Adams Van Houten, our AGMD Public Policy and Outreach Director, creator and head of numerous social media groups, and a multi-talented lady. She will be leading the participant question section of the program. Melissa, do you want to say hi?
Hi. Sorry about the technical issues earlier. I think I'm on. I think I can speak. thank you for having me and putting up with it.
This is the world of technical issues, so believe me, I always go on really, really early to these programs to make sure that everything is in order, and even having done that, you run into it. So during the first part of the program, I will be having a conversation with Dr. Cook regarding the vagus nerve, fund application, and post-surgical gastroparesis. During this part, we ask that you refrain from asking questions. During the second part of the program, Melissa Adams Van Houten, who I just introduced, will be leading the participants' question and answer section of the program. May I remind you to be in a quiet area because we can hear a lot of background on wherever you are located. And now I'd like to introduce and welcome Dr. Kenneth Cook. Dr. Cook has quite an extensive and impressive background. He currently serves as professor of medicine, a section on gastroenterology, hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in North Carolina. He has graciously agreed to share his time and expertise with our organization, and we're just so incredibly grateful. Dr. Cook, welcome.
All right. Hey, thank you, Angela, very much for the invitation to be with everybody today. So good morning. Here I'm in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And we think we're slowly getting ahead of the pandemic. So I hope everybody is doing well from that regard. So today we're going to talk about a topic that you all have proposed that, Mary Angela has a long list, but we thought talking a bit about the vagus nerve and then how the vagus nerve interacts with the GI tract, what it does to the GI tract. And as you know, there are a variety of operations where the vagus is damaged, even cut, and can result in gastric motility disorders. In fact, we think that the fundoplication done for GERD is one of the more common operations that can unfortunately result in damage to the vagus and damage to the motility, if you will, of the stomach, even leading to gastroparesis. So we're going to cover a bit of ground. We're going to leave a lot of time for questions. So the vagus nerve, it's one of the 12 cranial nerves, actually comes from the brain, and it's number 10. It's also called the wanderer. I think you'll find out in a moment, and the reason it does tend to wander. It wanders out of the brain. And it first goes to innervate the esophagus, and then the stomach, and then the small bowel, and then a portion of the colon. And so it really innervates the entire GI tract. But it also sends off branches to integrate the control of the heart and the lungs. It also has branches to the liver and the pancreas. So It is a major, major nerve for control and modulation of the GI tract, which we'll focus on. And I think, you know, what often is forgotten, that the vagus nerve is about 80% sensory. You know, its job is to feel, if you will, sense what's going on in the esophagus and the stomach and so on, and send those messages back to the brain for further, you might say, control, modulation, adjustment. And about 20% of the fibers are the ones that actually stimulate such things as acid secretion, stimulate contractions and relaxations of the esophagus and the stomach. So, needless to say, it's a important cranial nerve for what we're going to talk about. So this nerve kind of divides and comes down the esophagus in branches and plexi. And right at the end of the esophagus, the area where surgeries are done, like the fundoplication, the vagus nerve kind of splits in several directions and innervates the stomach. And it controls, for instance, the relaxation of the fundus. Remember, the fundus of the stomach is the upper portion, the part that first receives the food that we swallow. That part must relax to receive the food. It also stimulates then contractions in the corpus and antrum. Remember, the corpus and antrum are the part of the stomach that mix, thoroughly mix the food, get it broken down into little tiny particles, and then very carefully empty those particles of food through the pylorus into the duodenum. Down there, you know, the vagus nerve, as I mentioned, also affects the liver, the pancreas secretions, and the gallbladder. So those are some of the anatomical areas and some of the functional things that the vagus does. Going back to the stomach, when we activate the vagus nerve, like when we chew and swallow our food, the vagus nerve is activated to stimulate gastric acid. So the stomach has acid to help break down the food that we're ingesting. It also turns on the beginnings of those contractions that happen at 3 cycles per minute. 3 cycles per minute is the pacemaker rhythm of the stomach, created by the pacemaker cells in the stomach. And as you know, we talked about, the stomach has its own pacemaker system. It has its own, we call enteric nervous system. So, you know, even if the vagus gets cut or there is some damage, there is a very sophisticated, you might say, pacemaker and neural control of how the stomach functions. So basically, we can, you may have other questions about the vagus nerve, but, you know, that's what very basic overview of its function with the stomach. And I should mention, the vagus nerve is very important in the nervous system as a as part of what we call the parasympathetic nervous system. So that's the system when you take a slow, deep breath, if you're doing yoga, you're doing relaxation, a slow, deep breath that calms you down. That's the parasympathetic nervous system. It likes that, let's slow down and relax part of life. By the way, that's why it definitely is activated during dining or eating in a comfortable, pleasant area. You want that pleasant, comfortable feeling after you eat, as the parasympathetic nervous system is turned on to get digestion underway. You might also know that the other system that balances out the parasympathetic is the sympathetic nervous system. And so the sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight response system. So if during your lovely meal, the roof starts to leak, or I don't know, the kitchen catches on fire, you're out of there. You are activating the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight response. That the heart races, blood pressure goes up, you might sweat, and that's like the opposite of the parasympathetic. So, you know, some people think there are just those two systems, but actually there's a third system. It's the enteric nervous system. I mentioned briefly the gut has its own nervous system, and it has to sort of listen to these other two systems, the parasympathetic, sympathetic, and respond accordingly. So, wow, there's a little mini review then of the vagus and its big role in the parasympathetic nervous system, and contrasting it with the sympathetic. But so let's move on and talk about, well, let's talk about fundoplication. Many of you have a heartburn, I suspect. Heartburn is gastroesophageal reflux disease, where the acid that's being secreted into the stomach is actually refluxed into the esophagus. People get heartburn, they feel the regurgitation. It's very common in patients with gastroparesis. In fact, it's a risk factor for reflux because food sits there, liquid sits there in the stomach, doesn't get emptied, and so it's kind of available to reflux. So some patients who really aren't well controlled with the acid suppression drugs we have for heartburn, they try many of them. They just don't work. As part of the workup, they'll have endoscopy to show there's no stricture problem. You may have esophageal manometry to measure the lower sphincter pressure, to measure the contractions in the esophageal body, because there's certain parameters you want to see before you do any operation on the esophagus and the stomach, like a fundoplication. And it may even have a 24-hour pH study to show and document how much acid is really coming up into the esophagus. So, and here, you know, we also want to know before any surgery is done, do you have a normal stomach in terms of emptying? We often get the 4-hour gastric emptying study. We'll also get an electrogastrogram to look at the stomach's rhythm. We might do a water load satiety test to see how the stomach relaxes. So we like to know the physiology of the stomach and esophagus before we would go ahead and do an operation on the fundus. So the fundoplication, what does that mean? Well, basically, it's fairly simple and straightforward. That is the fundus of the stomach, that upper part, may even, you might consider it the upper third of the stomach, upper 25%, is the fundus, and it's thin-walled, it's a bit floppy, and it can literally be, you might say, pulled around the distal esophagus. The surgeon kind of frees up the area around that lower sphincter I mentioned, frees up that area from attachments, give some room to bring the fundus around that distal esophagus, and then literally puts two or three stitches to hold that wrap. Some people call it a wrap, because that bit of the fundus is wrapped 360 degrees around the distal esophagus and gently secured. What does that do? Well, that creates a pressure barrier to prevent further reflux. So it's harder after the fundoplication for acid and stomach juices to reflux into the esophagus. So, gee whiz, that surgery's been done for, I don't know, 50 years. It's kind of the standard surgical approach. And the problem, and it works most of the time it works great. People are happy that they don't have that constant heartburn, chest discomfort, regurgitation. But because there is manipulation up there around the distal end of the esophagus, and because as hard as the surgeon might look to see that he doesn't touch or stretch or cut the vagus nerve, there can be damage to the vagus nerve, and it's very hard to tell if and when it happened until later. Really, folks after the fundoplication might begin to experience, while they have less belching and heartburn, food is feeling very full in their stomach. They may feel like their food is not moving out of the stomach. Their prolonged fullness may have nausea, distension, and you know, these are some of the symptoms we've talked about before that go along with gastroparesis. You know, that the stomach doesn't feel like it's emptying. The bad thing is with this particular operation is because of that fundoplication, it's extremely difficult to belch or vomit. And so people can get into a very difficult situation, especially if the pylorus might be tight. Then food won't back up and food won't go out. It gets to be a very difficult situation, of course, if you've got this kind of a problem after a fundoplication. That is probably the big problem I want to just discuss. You may have some questions about that. You know, and back in the day, just to go back to other operations, back before we had these really good PPI therapies and drug therapy that suppressed acid, the way we decreased acid and tried to cure ulcers was by cutting the vagus nerve. Believe it or not, the vagus nerve was cut on purpose, and that would reduce acid secretion at least 50%. It's not the only way we secrete acid, but it's an important way. And it didn't take too long for the surgeons to appreciate, well, people were coming back with nausea and vomiting and delayed gastric emptying. So he certainly learned that the vagus was a factor in emptying. And they said, and that's where the vagotomy and pyloroplasty operation came from. They would say, well, okay, the stomach won't empty, so we'll cut that pylorus. It's a sphincter. It's resisting outflow. And for a while, the vagotomy and pyloroplasty was the operation of choice. You might say the least dramatic of the operations for ulcer. You know, if you had a really bad ulcer and it wouldn't heal, you'd have to sometimes remove, actually cut out the antrum, maybe even the pylorus. And you can imagine then you got into some huge difficulties because now you didn't have a vagus nerve and you didn't have part of the mixing chamber. So those operations, fortunately, are not done too much anymore because we have such good medicines. The other operations that you may have heard of that people get into trouble with, at least a minority, is a very large hiatal hernia. You know, like softball, you know, a good size hernia. Part of that much of the stomach is herniated up into the chest, and that can cause trouble with swallowing, chest discomfort. Again, the GERD problems. And when those large hernias are reduced, you know, the esophagus and the stomach is gently pulled down into the right position. And, you know, while the anatomy is corrected, sometimes that vagus nerve, I'm afraid, gets stretched, it gets damaged. And I've certainly seen patients after that operation for hernia that the symptoms of gastroparesis appear, and it's eventually that diagnosis is made with a gastric emptying study, so on. So there's a couple operations that I've mentioned where the vagus can get damaged and in one possibility, one route to gastroparesis. We often call these, post-surgical gastroparesis, as opposed to diabetic gastroparesis or idiopathic gastroparesis. So they're post-surgical. The patient, the doc, everybody figures out, these symptoms began after the operation. And so we kind of figure that's what happens. And so the diagnostic workup kind of goes back to what we've talked about before. You may do an endoscopy to look at the post-surgical anatomy. What does the stomach look like? Again, to make a diagnosis of gastroparesis, that's the 4-hour gastric emptying study, hopefully using egg beaters, the most standard test. The gastric emptying study is not the only study that shows some dysfunction of the stomach. The other one is the electrogastrogram, looks at the stomach's rhythm. You can also, and the rhythm that is normal is the 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm. I mentioned that's the rhythm that the pacemaker cells create. Can look at how much volume the stomach, can it relax? There's a water load test. The other test for the stomach motility, it would be the smart pill test. That's it's a capsule that can be ingested with a granola bar type test meal, and that shows gastric transit time. So there's ways to figure out, after surgery, get some physiologic data that makes that diagnosis. I'll say a couple words about treatment, and then maybe you'll have some questions, but it's like with gastroparesis that's idiopathic or it's or diabetic, the treatment is really the same with a couple caveats. You always start with diet, what foods are going to be the easiest for the weak stomach to mill and to empty. And so it really is staying hydrated with things like Gatorade or Propel, those electrolyte drinks. Liquids are, nutritious liquids are emptied easier than solids. So there's your smoothies, probably be the best. Some of the Ensure type drinks can feel pretty heavy and can be pretty calorie rich, so it may have to be diluted, but soups and smoothies, try and getting up to 1,000-1,200 calories a day to keep your nourishment up. Like drugs, none of the drugs we have been tested in post-surgical situations, so we still would try things like Reglan for a brief time as a side effects, erythromycin to make stronger contractions. Some of the things we do here, we want to make sure that the pylorus is not resisting flow. And we look at the rhythm, and a device called the EndoFlip can actually measure how distensible the pylorus is. As I mentioned, because if you have a fundoplication and you're doing very badly after that test and you've got symptoms of gastroparesis, we want to be sure that that the outflow of the stomach through the pylorus is normal or as normal as can be. And so in some patients where that's not the case, we'll put a balloon in there and dilate the pylorus, or sometimes use Botox in the pylorus in those specific cases. So it's difficult because, after the fundus has been wrapped, you don't have that fundus to relax and receive food. So many people feel full right away. because there isn't that ability to relax the fundus. It's been wrapped. And so people feel full right away and may have to limit their eating on that basis as well. You can't really get the vagus back. And so if it's been cut or damaged, it's pretty unusual in my experience that it can grow back and regain the function that it's lost. So post-surgical gastroparesis is certainly a bad kind of gastroparesis because, you know, it was started, you might say, an adverse outcome of a surgery done, you know, for the right reason, for a good reason, but it's an adverse event, certainly, if those kind of symptoms continue, you know, begin and continue after these operations. Mary Angela, what do you think? Did we cover most of the, those are kind of my remarks at this point. Did we miss anything that you wanted to?
Dr. Cook, I think you covered everything. Excellent, excellent education and information. So I do think this is a good time to hand the program over to Melissa for the participant question and answer part. And if you want to lay the ground rules, Melissa, that would be great.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, just a couple of pointers and ground rules for this portion of the call. If you can, please state your first name and your first name only when you're talking so that we know who we're speaking to. Do not give out your personal contact information at any point or ask for anyone else's. We ask that you refrain from using profanity when speaking out of respect for other members on the call. And please, most of all, be aware that we can hear any background noise that you're picking up. So if you're in a car and you have the radio playing or something along those lines, we can hear that. So if you're not speaking, it's sometimes very helpful to just mute your microphone. We want to make sure that we get as many people involved as possible. We want you all to have time for your questions. So please keep in mind that we do have quite a few callers with us today. And though we really want to hear from each and every one of you, we ask you to please share the microphone as well so that we can get as many questions in as possible. Is there anybody out there on the call who has a question?
I do. This is Mary Jo.
Hi, Mary Jo.
Hi. I have a question about stem cell, Dr. Cook. Are you guys working on it, or is anyone working on stem cell for post-surgical, you know, situations, or any situation for the vagus nerve?
Yeah, thank you. Not to my knowledge, not for the vagus nerve. There are some stem cell research going on to just repopulate, you know, smooth muscle or enteric neurons or pacemaker cells by infusing you might say, elementary stem cells. This is mostly work in mice, you know, and you know, animals, in particular with necrotizing enterocolitis that's seen in infants. And the hope is that these stem cells, when they find their way to the gut, recognize this environment and then differentiate into those three ingredients: smooth muscle cells for contraction, the enteric neurons to actually stimulate those contractions, and the pacemaker cells to regulate the contractions. So it's very complex to get the right blend of those elements. And there's some work in regenerative medicine, but you know, there's not really a way to regenerate the vagus nerve. I've not seen anything on this in terms of the kinds of post-surgical issues we've been talking about today. So maybe
so
in the
it
future,
wouldn't work. I'm sorry. So it wouldn't work for post-surgical. If anything, it would work just for like idiopathic or diabetic gastroparesis. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, basically those would be the areas. And for our research with the NIH consortium, there is a six center consortium that we're part of, and we are getting full thickness biopsies from the couple different areas in the stomach. And you see, even to know what cells to regenerate or what cells to infuse, you need to know what cells are missing. And it turns out that the smooth muscle cells look pretty good in the stomach in diabetic and idiopathic gastroparesis. But you know what's missing are the pacemaker cells. The interstitial cells of Cajal are depleted to variable degrees. So, and even the neurons aren't that much disordered, you see. So right now our thinking is what's really causing the basic problem is lack of rhythmicity, lack of rhythm control. And so I think we'll see in the future some looks to perhaps regenerating those missing cells, the interstitial cells of Cajal. How could we get those back into the stomach or other organs? Could they go to the right places? Could they link up with the smooth muscle cells and the neurons? And could you, you know, reestablish rhythm and peristalsis? Pretty big order, isn't it?
So, yeah.
Pretty big order. So, you know, the GI tract, it's very sophisticated. It's extremely sophisticated what it does for us every day. And so, you know, we have to get a lot smarter about what's missing, and then are there workarounds, or really should we be thinking about, you know, regenerating from some cell? It might be, by the way, the gut itself has stem cells. The gut itself has stem cells that can be isolated. And those stem cells, of course, are there for repair. You may need a new muscle, some muscle cells. You may need some neurons. You know, we're always regenerating. We're always remodeling ourselves. And so there's some opportunities there at basic science level for the future.
Well, we need hope, you know, and there's no cures out there. And I keep praying for a cure. And yes. my gut tells me it's stem cell, but you're saying even if my vagus nerve was just damaged from surgery and not cut, then if my vagus nerve was not cut, it was just damaged, is there any hope at
I think with any nerve that is damaged and you know, from day one, the damaged nerve is trying to repair. You know, some folks get better over time, and you know, you have to give it 6 months or a year.
It's been 7 years.
Yeah, 7 years, like no improvement. If there's 7 years and no improvement, then I think that nerve has been damaged. Whatever was damaged has been damaged severely, and you're not getting function back. You have to find these other workarounds because we don't have, if it was vagal damage, we don't have a way to go in there and, you know, make that nerve whole again. That's the problem with any surgery, right? Any surgery these days, if you remove it, if you cut it out, if you damage it, it's just not there again. And so, that's the problem with, you know, ancient or modern surgery. Something is removed, it's gone, you don't have it anymore.
Dr. Cook, this is Melissa. We got a lot of questions about whether gallbladder surgery, even laparoscopic gallbladder surgery, can result in damage to the vagus nerve. Do you see that commonly?
Well, it's a great question, and I wonder, it's a great question for this reason. I've had a few patients, well, it's It's a good question for several reasons. Number one, many patients with gastroparesis have their gallbladders out. Almost 70% of my patients that I see for the first time already have their gallbladders out. And I say, like, well, why'd you have it out? Well, they had it out because they thought the abdominal discomfort and the nausea and the distension after eating was due to the gallbladder. And so the gallbladder comes out, but the patients know better, and then we find gastroparesis. So in most patients, I think the gastroparesis was there before the gallbladder came out. And you know, it sounds like gallbladder. Maybe the gallbladder had a few stones in it. Maybe the gallbladder had delayed emptying, and that's okay. We have to, that's a possibility, and now it's gone. We don't have to worry about the gallbladder. We focus on the real symptoms, or that the real problem being the stomach. The stomach doesn't empty. It's in a bad rhythm. It doesn't relax. Whatever. Those are the areas of function we can look into. But I must say, I've had some few patients, where the gallbladder comes out, and I think after that, they have either more GERD or they have more stomach problems that seem to be new. And here's, don't know that it's been studied, but you know, the gallbladder, to take it out, you do have to cut through the vagal nerves to the gallbladder. You do some dissecting up there under the liver. You know, blood vessels are cut. And I'm not so sure that there isn't some residual issue where that vagus nerve now, remember I said it was 80% afferent, it's not sensing the gallbladder anymore. Is there some sort of retrograde damage, and you're not quite the same after that gallbladder? There is a residual. So you know, but we think it's just to a branch, it's to a side branch, it's not a damage to the main trunk. The main trunk is going, you know, down the esophagus, branches to the heart, and the lungs that are pretty substantial. The gallbladder we don't think of as a very big deal, but I do wonder, and maybe some of you have you know, noticed this or have a personal observation, but so theoretically, yes, you cut those branches. Yes, there were side branches, but they somehow affect the main track. It's a possibility.
Thank you. Anybody else out there who has a question for Dr. Cook?
I have a question.
Yes. I think I heard Terry, Ms. Terry first.
Yes, thank you. In 2016, I had a 270 toupee wrap instead of the Nissen. Yes. I had a large periesophageal hernia, so it moved my stomach down, and then they wanted to help salvage my ability to burp. And then I've also had my gallbladder out and my entire colon out. Well, a short while back, I had the pyloric balloon dilation and the Botox injections. And what I'm wondering is, a doctor that I talked to after that thought that perhaps having the Botox injections and the balloon dilation done repeatedly could ultimately have a negative effect should I decide on getting a POP or a POLM surgery for the pylorus. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's you're kind of getting into the issues that I alluded to, right? Because
right,
couple things. They didn't do the full 360 classic fundoplication. They did the toupee, which is 270. So it's not quite as tight because they wanted you to be able to burp and release some air. That's a way to vent the stomach when you get too much pressure in the stomach. So I don't know, did you have gastroparesis before this toupee operation?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I did. But other doctors, like when I went to the Cleveland Clinic, they didn't think that this was a vagus nerve. So different doctors have different levels of thinking that way. However, with that and the gallbladder surgery and the total colectomy, I'm thinking there's a pretty good chance that, like our last person who asked a question was talking about, maybe it didn't get cut, but maybe it was damaged somehow.
Yeah, well, and for fundoplication or the toupee, the surgeon is working very hard to avoid even touching the nerves. They know about this. They are working very hard not to disturb the vagus nerve. So despite that, you know, there can be problems. And if there is delayed emptying afterwards, well, you say, I didn't have this before. And so despite everything going well, this is where we are now. So then the issue becomes, what kind of gastroparesis do you have? And I've mentioned before, we're beginning to subtype the gastroparesis based on the electrical rhythm that is still present. And for instance, we have patients who have a very normal 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm, but they can't empty. They have gastroparesis. That person may have a tight pylorus, and they make the best candidates, in our experience, they make the best candidates for the pyloric Botox or balloon because they've got a good rhythm. Now you have a tight pyloric sphincter, and you empty better. But you had if you had a vagal damage, you may have a dysrhythmia, an electrical rhythm problem of the stomach. But you may have a second problem. The second problem is that pylorus again. And now, if you try to make the pylorus relax more with your Botox or balloon, you may get some better, but you still have a problem there in the stomach. So we're beginning to think, you know, we got to be aware of what the stomach corpus and antrum are doing rhythm-wise, contraction-wise, but also have to be aware of what that pylorus is doing. Is it in spasm? Won't it relax? So did you have any benefit of the pylorus dilation or Botox?
I believe I did. It's a little bit hard to tell because at the same time, I also had a G-tube placed simply for drainage. Yeah. I can eat with my mouth, and I still have my port for the TPN I was on for quite a while. So I still, it's not, the G-tube was not at all for feeding. It was totally for drainage and distension. So I had both of those procedures done at the same time. So it's a little hard to tell. And of course the doctors say it's not standard practice to do any tests to measure the pylorus, which they did prior to blowing it up with a balloon and shooting the injections just to see what size it is now. They said, if your symptoms come back, we'll inject it again. That's when another doctor said, well, wait a minute, if you're thinking you're heading to a POEM surgery, you might want to cool it on these injections and balloon dilations because that could have a negative effect if you wanted to just cut that pylorus in the future.
Yeah that's right at the kind of state of our knowledge, those thoughts. Why? Because it's thought that you know, maybe up to 2 or 3 Botox injections is okay, but after that you start getting some scar tissue. You can get some inflammation around where the injection went in, and makes it more difficult for the surgeon or the gastro to do the GPOM. They have a little more difficulty finding their way. With the balloon dilation, I haven't seen anybody talk about that. Does that do the same thing? It might, although you know the balloon is more of a stretching injury versus the injection of Botox. So that's what they're getting at.
Thank you.
If one is thinking about going towards a GPOM, I think you'll find the doctors increasingly saying, I don't think we want to do too many more of these Botox. But if you have a good response, it's my opinion, if you really feel better after a Botox or a balloon dilation, it may last for a month or two or even four or more, that's a pretty good signal that the pylorus is contributing. And so this is what I look for to help me make that decision that the pylorus is important in the symptoms. And then you and your doctor can decide, you know, how much more of the endoscopic treatment you want to do versus going ahead for cutting the sphincter.
And then just the last part of this real quick is, how smart is it to go through with a GPOM surgery if you're dumping into a small intestine that has lousy motility proven by the smart pill?
Yeah, this is how complicated it is.
And I have system-wide, it's mouth to anus with me, yeah, with motility.
So I'm probably extremely cautious about any cut on the pylorus, because, you know, you're going to destroy a sphincter and you're going to make it very loose. And people who tell me, well, they've read the internet, they don't want to have dumping syndrome, they don't want to go from delayed to rapid. And rapid emptying, I've had patients say, well, I think I can deal with the rapid emptying a little more than the delayed. But, you know, some of the symptoms are the same. After eating, distension, nausea, even vomiting. So it's a real tricky decision in my view, because we don't know quite exactly, all the long-term side effects, or even how long GPOM effect will last. So you're right at the cutting edge there, so to speak, of our thought processes. And yeah, I've had patients who say, you know, now I know I don't want surgery. I'm getting 3 to 4 months of real benefit from the Botox or the balloon. I have a number of patients who literally come back every 4 months and have these kind of Botox balloon therapies.
Okay, well then maybe that sounds like stick with that for a little while, especially since my small bowel doesn't work and I don't even have a large colon. So dumping this probably gets really dumpy when you don't have a colon either.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
That's okay, thank you.
We actually had someone submit a question sort of related to this through the website. She says, my daughter is 51 years old. She's been diagnosed with gastroparesis. She has had gallbladder surgery, Nissen fundoplication, and hernia surgery twice. The surgeon cut her stomach muscle to help her stomach empty better. She has also recently had a heart attack. She weighs only 53 pounds. Is there help for her? And if so, where should she start?
Yeah, wow, post-surgical gastroparesis, worst case. Two fundoplications, it sounds like they may have done the pyloroplasty, and still the person cannot maintain their nutrition. So when I have a patient like this, you know, and I presume they want to weigh 100 pounds, let's say, your esophagus and stomach just can't, are not up to the task. Then the shift becomes one thing, nutrition. And much as we don't like to go to a TPN, you know, total parenteral nutrition, a person who gets too weak, loses too much weight, you need to start talking about putting in a central line and getting your food through veins. You know, I have patients who start losing weight and I can tell that they cannot eat enough calories to support a decent weight we may try to get in a jejunal feeding tube. They're going to need nutritional support for the long haul, not a week, not 2 weeks, months. I say maybe 6 months. Let's put the jejunal tube in and get your weight up to 100 pounds or 110. So you'll feel better just with hydration and calories, and then we can go back to talking about eating. And if that's not feasible, then just to get weight up, you have to think about TPN. So I think at this point, that's what the focus should be on, nutritional support.
Thank you. Does anyone else in the call have?
I did.
Yes, ma'am.
I did. My name
I'll go after the call.
Sorry, hey, my name is Lisa.
Lisa, are you? I'm sorry, Miss Lisa. Was that you talking also? Okay, so who is speaking right now?
Who's this?
And Nicole, do you want to go, and then I will. I'm Mary.
I was kind of waiting on the last lady too. Sorry.
Okay, we will go with.
Okay. Ms. Lisa. I'll go ahead if it's okay.
My question was for post-surgical causes of gastroparesis. We didn't talk about super mesenteric artery syndrome. My question is, does super mesenteric artery syndrome, that surgery can cause gastroparesis, or is it maybe the compression that causes it before the surgery? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, that one is a tricky one also. That particular syndrome is thought that it's the artery kind of laying over the duodenum and really giving a form of obstruction. So the idea is, if you kind of free the duodenum, you relieve that compression, you should have normal emptying. Okay, it should be better. That syndrome is a bit controversial. I'm taking care of a young lady right now, a college student, you know, who had they freed up the artery, but they also did some sort of a bypass around the duodenum, and she didn't do well. She's still has her same syndrome, and she still has gastroparesis, a very severe gastroparesis. So you know, I think when the SMA diagnosis is provided, I think we still have to look through a lot of different tests, and perhaps certainly need a gastric emptying study. I need to, if you can subtype it, is there a normal rhythm? Is there a pyloric problem? Is this really causing the symptoms, or are the symptoms really due to bacterial overgrowth in the small bowel, or even irritable bowel syndrome? So, you know, you just have to be very careful. So, I don't think, so that's my comment. SMA is thought to actually cause the gastroparesis. You know, relieving that duodenum should make it better, should not cause gastroparesis.
Got it. Thank you. I'm in the same boat as your other patients, where they rerouted it, and it's worse.
Yeah, you mean that they actually did some additional, they rerouted the artery, or they rerouted some of the stomach's duodenum?
They rerouted the duodenum.
Yeah, that's what my patient has. And so I don't quite. And did you have a gastric emptying study before the surgery and everything?
No, after. They did it after, and that's when they diagnosed gastroparesis and then nutcracker esophagus with manometry as well.
Yeah, so you know, when I do any operation, or you know, if I think there could be a blood flow problem and anatomy problem with the arteries, I say, well, that's fine. I see that problem, but let's see if that problem matches up with a actual physiological measure. let's see what it matches up with. And so before surgery, I would get a gastric emptying. I would get an electrogastrogram with water load. Depending on what I saw, I might even think about the pylorus. Do you see what I mean? And I say, what if all those things were normal? And they thought the SMA was an issue. You know, if all those things were abnormal before surgery, I'd say, okay, maybe that artery is related. Yeah. So anyway, it's a different way of thinking about things. But yeah, if they rerouted, so then it gets into some complicated surgery, making anastomoses, and lo and behold, you're not that much better afterwards. And now they found now they have gastroparesis that you're dealing with. I think probably more to do with that surgery on the stomach duodenum area could have eventuated in the gastroparesis, a post-surgical gastroparesis perhaps, since it wasn't sure what it was before the surgery.
Thank you. Yeah, that's
Just another minute. Miss Mary, I believe you were the other person that was wanting to ask a question.
Yes, thank you. I had the fundoplication, the surgery, and was came out with the gastroparesis. I've been on the TPN for a period of time and then tried to tube feed for a period of time. But now I am in a study with Propulsid or Cisapride that's off the market unless you're in the study. Like another caller, I do have system-wide motility issues. But what I'm experiencing, and doctor, I wanted to know if this makes sense or if you are familiar with this, because of the timing, I have both a G-tube and a J-tube. The G-tube, I put all my medicine in, and the J-tube, I drain out of.
Mm-hmm.
But I experience really high blood sugars and really low blood sugars, just kind of a roller coaster. And I wasn't diabetic, but I've been told it's a timing issue because you never know when the stomach's going to process or from there. Have you had other patients with this?
Yeah. Is your question about the fluctuating glucoses?
Yes, and if you're familiar with the Propulsid study and if it could be a factor in it, although it's what's enabling me to eat now.
Yeah, well, certainly Cisapride was a promising drug back in the day. There were some cardiac, you know, side effects that were enough that they pulled it off of development. And you know, it did help stomach and dyspepsia symptoms. So maybe they have tweaked the molecule so it doesn't have so much cardiac issue. But it's a prokinetic and may help stomach emptying, small bowel emptying as well, small bowel motility. But I think, the way that food is presented, you know, through the J-tube or through intermittent eating by mouth, it does present a challenge to your insulin system. Do you have diabetes?
I get really highs and then I get really lows.
Yeah. Well, that may have to do with how, and are you taking some feedings through your J-tube?
No.
All of your feedings are by mouth?
Yes, unless I get dehydrated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a little surprised that they go up and down so much from your stomach, you know, and you could have a dietitian just look at, you know, what are the exact liquids or solids that you're eating. I mean, solids should come out slowly and not cause this. Liquids could come out too fast and or a bit uncontrolled. And so maybe, again, I would just look at the diet very closely. If you have a dietitian who can go over what it is you're eating through the day, maybe plot some numbers. That's certainly where I would start. And also, it's nice to know how your stomach, if you hadn't had a gastric emptying study for a while, make sure it's up to date and maybe there's something there that has changed. So there's a couple ideas for you for that glucose business.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so I have to close. I hope that you'll join us on April 20th, where Dr. Cook is going to be talking about gastroparesis and functional dyspepsia. Are they the same? First, I want to thank Dr. Cook. Dr. Cook, thank you for your dedication and your commitment, not only to patients and your research, but to our organization. We continue to be grateful beyond measure. And thank you, Melissa, for leading the participant question and answer section. And thanks to all of you for your willingness to learn and share your voice and display such courage on a daily basis as you go through your medical journeys. You're all heroes, including Dr. Cook. Thank you again. God bless you all.